Dante Beaujeau, this is At the Edge of Canada with TJ Phillips, bringing you live check-ins with all the major players in the Indigenous intellectual community throughout southern Manitoba and across the country. This week's show, we wrap up our Inuit Showcase by checking in with Inuk graphic artist Aviak Johnson. She's out in Algonquin Territory, that's Ottawa, where she works in student support with Inuit learners. And we talk about student support methods, reading engagement, didacticism of literature, and all of the teachings, Inuit cultural history, and lessons that are in her book, the newest book, nominated for a Governor General Award, nominated for a Bird Award. That's Those Who Run in the Sky. Aviak is a fierce defender of Inuit history, land claim, seal hunting rights, and one of the strongest voices in the Indigenous literary community. It's a fantastic way to wrap up our first installment of the second season, that is the fall semester of 2017. We'll be back next semester with a whole new slate of interviews and check-ins with all the major players in the Indigenous intellectual community. But enjoy this. We caught up with Aviak Johnson a couple of months ago, around the time things were kind of going on with the Edmonton Football Club name here in Winnipeg, to talk about all matters of Inuit literature. This is Aviak Johnson on At the Edge of Canada. Hey, it's Trevor from At the Edge of Canada. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Where am I reaching you?
I'm in Ottawa at work.
Oh, you're at work. What do you do for a day job?
I work at a college for Inuit youth.
Oh, cool.
It's called Nunavut Siwuniksavut. It's a really cool program. It's 8 months long. Students learn about Inuit history and Inuit contemporary issues. And it's also like college prep, so they get a lot of basic skills in like post-secondary setting, and then they get credits for college and university, so they can go on to other post-secondary with credits already.
I work in student support as well, and I work with graduate students, and I find that in doing that work, you figure out, you know, how hostile classrooms can be for Indigenous learners, and I bet it's really supportive to have that environment for Inuit learners.
Yeah, our program is very different from a lot of post-secondary institutions because we always create really good relationships with our students. Like, mm-hmm. We only accept 60 students a year.
Oh, really?
And so we have a really good relationship with them, and we're like all up in their business every day.
That's the best way to do it, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of our students end up being really successful.
That's really awesome. That's amazing to hear. And whereabouts in the north do you get most of your students from?
Primarily from Nunavut. There's like three different regions in Nunavut, so we get funding from there. So we get a lot from Baffin and from the like central Nunavut.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we get a few from the western part of Nunavut called Pitimiut. But we also, sometimes we get students from Labrador and sometimes from Northwest Territories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if our students are, or sometimes we also get like urban Inuit, like so Inuit who grew up in Ottawa or somewhere in the south.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm doing a bit of a showcase of Inuit writing, and I interviewed Ken Harper about his book, Thou Shall Not Do No Murder, and it's mm-hmm. about a murder up in the north back in the 1920s. And I told him that I was going to be interviewing you, and he told me a story about how his daughter is named after you.
Yeah.
Can you tell me your version of that story?
Well, my name's Greenlandic, so Avyat is it's a traditionally a boy's name in Greenland.
Oh,
but,
okay.
It became a woman's name through the years. And then Ken Harper's book, I Want My Father's Body.
Okay.
Or Give Me My Father's Body. It's about this young Greenlandic guy whose father died in a museum and his bones were like put on display. One of the girls in that story, her name's Avia. And I think Ken Harper named his daughter after that Avia in that book.
Okay.
But when my mom was pregnant with me, she was in Greenland. And the girl that would babysit my sister, her name was Avia, so my mom named me after that girl.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it's like a relatively popular name in Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Greenland once, and I think the first person I met when I got on land was a girl named Avia.
That's actually such a cool story. I should have known that when I started to talk to writers from the north in Enoch's up there that eventually some communities and relationships would collide. I didn't realize it would be right off the bat like that. That's so awesome.
Yeah.
I'm really happy you came on the show today because I want to talk to you about Those Who Run in the Sky, your latest book for young adult fiction that's just getting so much praise. It's nominated for BERT Award, the Governor General Award. And the first question I want to ask you is, actually, it's not a question. It's more of a compliment. I love your epigraphs at the beginning. Your epigraph game is very solid. And it reads, "For Marley, you deserve the world, but all I have to offer you is this book." And that's like the sweetest thing ever. So can you tell me who Marley is and why you wrote that?
Marley's my best friend. And she last year, her mom passed away. I was already going to dedicate it to Marley because she helped me so much with editing and like with story development and all that. So I was already going to dedicate it to her. But after her mom died, I felt like she deserved so much because she also lost her dad when she was a teenager. So I really think she deserves so much in this world. And all I had was her name in my book forever. So that's how I dedicated it to her.
That's an incredibly sweet story. Thank you for sharing that with us. The other epigraph is, "And for Indigenous youth everywhere, you deserve a story where you can be the main character." And that's incredibly sweet in and of itself as well. Tell me about why you wrote that.
I grew up reading books like Harry Potter. And, like, a lot of the books I read were from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And they're amazing books, and I loved them. But it took me a while to realize that I wasn't anywhere in those stories. Like, they didn't have Indigenous people in those stories very rarely. And if they did, it was very, like, wrong. Like, the wrong, like, it wasn't a accurate representation of Indigenous people, especially of Inuit. I find Inuit, there's not a lot known, and we're often called Eskimos in literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I wanted young Inuit like myself who love reading but can never relate too much to the stories. It's really cool because it's all in Inuit legends and traditional lifestyle. A lot of our youth are still very in touch with that. And a lot of them aren't, but I just wanted to include both sides.
You mentioned in a lot of other media you've done around Those Who Run in the Sky that you really credit your writing ability to being a voracious and avid reader. So you mentioned, I've read some media where you've mentioned Stephen King as a current influence right now that you've been reading. Who are you reading right now and who's inspiring you in the literary world?
So I just finished a Stephen King collection of short stories, which I really loved. And it's actually like my first real, my first time finishing a Stephen King book. I've started a lot, but that was my first time.
Yeah, me too.
it was my first time actually finishing one, and I really enjoyed it. It's Hearts in Atlantis,
okay.
Which was great. And I'm also currently reading Queen of Shadows by Sarah J. Maas.
Okay.
And it's like high fantasy, young adult, in a world where there's magic, and it's kind of like Game of Thrones, and it's really gory. So I'm sure my chapters while I'm reading this are going to be more gory. For me, like, reading, my family is called a book club because it's so popular. Like, me and my, we sit around dinner talking about books all the time. And whenever we have guests, they're like, I remember one of my sister's friends just saying, did I join a book club? So, I mean, that's why I'm so, like, so big in literature, because I grew up talking about books all the time with my family.
So before we dig into the book and the story of, is this how you say it? Paternik?
Paternik.
I don't think I could do that. There's a lot going on there that I don't think my tongue can do. Can I say P2? Is that shorter? How do you say the short version?
P2, yeah.
P2. Okay, I'll say P2 because I don't think I can do the full one. This is a story of a young hunter who's destined to become a shaman, and then he gets lost in the spirit world. And before we dig into that, I got one more political question. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but it's kind of the buzz around here in Winnipeg right now. There's a big football game happening on Sunday between Winnipeg and Edmonton, and our mayor just spoke out about the name of the Edmonton Football Club and it being, you know, woefully inappropriate for this day and age. As an Inuk woman, what do you feel about this conversation?
I mean, I don't pay attention to sports, but it's funny because I do think the name should change. Like,
yeah,
I think it's only appropriate if Inuit call each other Eskimos.
Hmm.
When I was a kid, I used to think it was cool that there was a team called the Eskimos, mm-hmm. like Edmonton Eskimos, because that was like, oh, that's what we're called. But now that I'm older, I'm like, why would they be called that? That doesn't make sense. I do think it should be changed.
Yeah, and Nathan Obed has said the same thing, right? He's spoken out against the name as well, hasn't he? And, you know, it's generally my opinion is that when a group of people start to say, hey, we don't like this, then maybe it's time to make a change.
Yeah.
And I'm from Edmonton, and I grew up watching the Canadian Football League. And, you know, I don't have any affiliation to the name. I don't have any objection if it's changed. I, in fact, think it should be changed to something fun, like the Elegant Elks or something. That sounds way more cool.
Yeah.
So P2 is a hunter. He's a young hunter. He's a great hunter. And here's the thing I know when you start to hear stories about hunters who are destined to become shamans, or they have a destiny to be fulfilled as being a medicine person of some kind. And any story I ever heard, I know that they're going to get lost, and they're going to get lost for a really long time. So why is it so important that these guys got to go and get lost out there? What are they trying to learn? Like, I mean, by the end of the book, I think I got a sense of what needed to be learned. There's a whole lot of lessons, but in your mind, like, what's the most important thing for P2 to learn as he gets lost out there in the fog?
Big important lessons I had through my life is learning how to be comfortable with myself. And I think in order to gain his full confidence as a shaman and just as a human being, Pitu like really learns that when he's lost. And I think that's probably common in a lot of things, is just learning to become comfortable with oneself. And Pitu happens to not be alone for a lot of it.
Yeah.
But he really learns how to kind of think his way through stuff and use his mind and his newfound abilities to kind of overcome a lot of his challenges.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. He does get a ton of help from a bunch of very different characters and even one very classic sort of surly elder shaman who helps him. That's Turnuk, right? Is that how you say, his name?
Tuk-tuk.
The best part of this is just you telling me how to say all these names. Okay, and how do you say P2's love interest, his future partner? How do you say her name?
Saima.
Yeah. Okay, so here's a question I had for you about Saima. Is that I think it's very clear that Saima is just like messing with P2's energies in so many different ways and like really destabilizing him. What are the stories around like the strength and energy of Inuk women just to like mess with hunters like that?
I don't really know how to answer because I am an Inuk woman.
Yeah, so you know exactly what you can do. Yeah.
I think the relationships between like Inuit men and Inuit women back in the day, like they relied so heavily on each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to, like, the classic thing in Western stories is, like, the men provide for the women and the women can't look after themselves or they need a husband. But really, it was a husband needed a wife in Inuit society because they had to, Inuit men did a lot of work, mm-hmm. but Inuit women, like, did everything else, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Like, they looked after the families, they made all the clothing, they did all the stuff. And then they also, a lot of the time, had really good senses of humor. And women had just as high or a higher standing in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And Saima is really like a depiction of a woman who likes to have fun and knows that she's going to be like one of the more well-known type of people. So she was going to have fun with it.
Well, the thing to me is Saima's like just messing up poor P2, you know, every which way. He's jealous of her looking at anyone. When naturally he's a fairly easygoing guy that way,
mm-hmm.
she disorients his senses to the point where part of the reason he gets lost is because he's thinking about her and trying to get back home to her mm-hmm. when he goes out to hunt. I found it an incredibly powerful teaching lesson about, you know, about relationship building, about healthy relationship building emotionally for like young, you know, Inuit men, you know, basically mm-hmm. like, you know, you got to take care of yourself and be a strong person for an Inuit woman, especially a mm-hmm. strong one who's going to test
yeah.
you, you know, I thought I was like, that's so true. That's like basically every Indigenous woman I've ever met. They just, you know, they keep me honest. They keep me focused on what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly lush book full of Inuit culture, teachings, story, and elements. The mm-hmm. texture is so rich, and I mean, it's a testament to you being such a traditional person yourself. And I'm just, I guess, I think my question is, you know, how much of this story is a teaching story? How much of it is an entertaining story? Like, did you think about that kind of thing, or is it just a product of, you know, telling a story, telling an Inuit story, and that's what you get? You get some teaching, you get some entertainment, and you get some magic, and you get some magical storms in the north.
I think I wrote it mostly to be entertaining.
Yeah.
But throughout writing it, I realized I was putting like a well, I think it was after I wrote it, I was like, there's a message, and it's like about, like I said earlier, being comfortable with yourself.
Yeah.
And yeah, for most part, it was just to be something that would have entertained me when I was 15 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. A couple of weekends ago, I saw Althea, and you can help me with this name too, Arnakuk Baril. How do you say her name?
Yeah. Alicia Angdakuk Baril.
That's awesome. I saw Alethea's documentary, Angry Enoch, and at a social justice film festival here at the University of Winnipeg, and it was incredibly moving story about the resilience of Inuit seal hunters and families that are affected by the seal hunts, and which is pretty much all the families in the north.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what that documentary is meant to those communities? And you're originally from Iglulik?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what is that documentary meant for your community and your region?
Well, seal hunting in my community was such a big thing. And in my family too, because my dad would take us seal hunting all the time, and my dad worked at the local grocery store, and he was, every spring we would have a group, all the staff from the store, we would all go hunting together for a seal.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates like a really good bond to that experience of hunting. But it wasn't until I was in college that I realized how much the ban, like the seal ban and
mm-hmm.
all that, has affected our communities. It's been such a struggle to get the seal hunting industry recognized, and I really appreciate Alicia, and I know her, and I gave her a copy of this book and said, I wrote in it saying your next movie with a question mark. And I really appreciate all the hard work she's done. I'm actually a part of one of the protests that she filmed in the
oh, really?
In Angry Inuk. Yeah. And it's educated me a lot, and I'm so thankful for how much it's educating the rest of the world.
That's awesome. I didn't know you were in that way. What were you doing? You were a protester?
Yeah, there was the protest in Toronto.
Yeah.
Where the I think it was IFA, they were having a protest about the seal hunt, and then we went there as a counter protest.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They ended up not showing up.
Okay. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I was in that group.
Oh, okay.
She had the Nunavut Sivunik Savut students there.
Yeah.
And I was a student at the time.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, yeah.
That's so cool. Mm-hmm. I wrote her a fan letter thanking her for that documentary and inspiring me mm-hmm. to want to shoot a documentary about the Métis Nation and fishing. So I'm just like incredibly enamored with her and that film. And that's so cool that you're in that.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, Aviak. Those Who Run in the Sky out of Inhabit Media, it's out now. It came out in the spring. It's just getting all kinds of love. It's a really great story about a young hunter, and I just enjoyed it so immensely. Enjoy talking to you. Thank you. And everything you do in the name of Indigenous literature, Indigenous student support, Inuit culture, Inuit storytelling, and being the fierce Inuk woman you are. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
We interrupt the end of At the Edge of Canada to bring you a live headline news update from the leader in Indigenous news, broadcasting from a nest in the rafters of Portage Place Mall in downtown Winnipeg. It's Tim Fontaine, head correspondent of Walking Eagle News.
From Walking Eagle News World Headquarters, here are the stories making headlines in Indigenous country right now. On the heels of a controversial decision about a destructive dam project, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has challenged British Columbia Premier John Horgan to a disappoint-off. A popular newspaper columnist has stirred up controversy once again by saying Canadians should do the opposite of whatever Indigenous peoples want. And Federal Finance Minister Bill Morneau has worked out a deal with the provinces that sees First Nations get 0% of legalized pot tax revenues. You'll find those stories and more at WalkingEagleNews.com. Journalism so profoundly Indigenous, everywhere we step becomes a reserve.
Thank you, Walking Eagle News, for that update. Hard-hitting news at the home for Indigenous news today. Make sure you follow Tim at The Eagleist on Twitter and check out walkingeaglenews.com. Absolutely killing it. That's it for 2017 from At the Edge of Canada. We'll be back next year, January 8th, with University of Manitoba, University of Winnipeg, Master's Student in Peace and Conflict Studies, Kathleen Wilson. Until then, have a great holiday, everyone. Happy solstice, and we'll see you next year. At the Edge of Canada is produced at the UMFM studios on the University of Manitoba campus in Winnipeg, Manitoba. The University of Manitoba is situated on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. You can get all updated podcasts and live streams for At the Edge of Canada at umfm.com, or you can listen to us live on the UMFM app. The lead track is Nehewak Starlight. And if you like what you hear from me, you can follow me on Twitter at tfillers. Up next, your campus today. And then I wished I had some kind of memory of a past so quickly changed. This is my